Thanks for coming in from the cold on a dreary day in Washington. It's great to have our two guests here today. Thank you very much, Rabbi Wolf and Shoji. Thank you, sir, for coming. My name is Ricky Ellison. I'm the chairman and founder of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization built in 2003. And our sole mission is basically to advocate and educate for the deployment and development of missile defenses around the world. We believe missile defense makes the world a safer place. Timing's everything, and we're here today to talk about two major things. One is the best engineering solution for the ballistic missile defense of the country of Japan and its 127 million people. And we're also here to recognize this partnership, which is the best in the world with the United States on ballistic missile defense and any other country in terms of integration, interoperability, and resourcing on it. I was in Japan last month. We were there for a historic first. We celebrated hosted with the Japanese military, their first Missile Defender of the Year. And we were able to bring in all three of their services for the first time, and our U.S. counter services that are deployed in Japan. It was an opportunity at that point to really put forward how important Japan was, and being the first before President Trump put that 100% support behind Japan. We were there 4 days. Right after the first intercept test of the SM-3 Block 2A missile. And we were in Japan, in Tokyo, when the North Korean made the launch on February 12th with that air-launched mobile submarine-lofted threat that they demonstrated on that day. We were able to go to Korea also on that same day, spent a couple days in Korea, and then came back through Okinawa and into Japan and met with some of the government military on the threat a little bit and on some of the solutions that they were considering on doing. We're very familiar with Japan. Our first event with Japan was in 2007, where we hosted the entire Congo ship after their first intercept with their SM-3 Block 1A missile in Hawaii. We've done numerous events both in Hawaii and both in Yokosuka and Yokota air bases and Okinawa throughout our reign as an advocacy group. Our missile defense, to start it off with Japan, came about with President Ronald Reagan, and a lot of us in this room were inspired by that 1983 SDI speech, and Japan was inspired by that speech. And they started to open up their exports to be able to facilitate military cooperation with the United States. In 1941, we started the first bilateral study on BMD was established between Japan and the United States. And in August 1999, the first MOU that we're seeing today come through was done. So I'm going to pass it over now to Rear Admiral Johnny Wolf to carry the history through the program. Rear Admiral Wolf is kind of the guy, the leader of his team that has done some phenomenal capability in terms of putting SM-3 Block 2A into the reality of intercepting ballistic missile targets and so forth. He runs the ballistic missile defense portion of MDA. I think it's around $1 billion a year that he oversees. So ladies and gentlemen, Rear Admiral Johnny Wolf.
Thanks, Ricky. Thanks for hosting this event. And thanks for giving Mr. Maeda and I a chance to talk about, A, the great success that this program has had, and to really talk about the Cooperative Development Program, what we call SCD, and really walk you through what this means to both our nations and kind of walk you through the history of the successes we've had. And Mr. Maeda, thank you, sir, for being here. And again, the partnership that our two nations have on this program, I think, is a model for how we ought to be doing business, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And what your government and what your contractors have brought is just absolutely phenomenal. So what I'd like to do is let me give you a little bit of history about the SCD program and kind of talk to you about where we've been, where we're at, and where we're going to go in this program. So Ricky kind of took you up to the point of where we decided we were going to do this cooperative development. So in 2006 is when we bilaterally decided we were going to go have a cooperative development. And this is truly a cooperative development program. And it was really driven by the need to have a more capable Standard Missile 3 family that could help us extend the battle space as our regional threats continue to grow, as we continue to look at what capability is needed. This weapon, as we go through development, truly does what I call expand the battle space. It gives us more reach. It gives us more capability to go against some of these advanced medium-range and intermediate-range ballistic missile regional threats. And it really allows both of our navies, it will allow both of our navies to truly have a new capability, reach out further, get out there quicker, and go against some of these more capable threats. And when I say it's really been a cooperative development program, I mean it's truly been a cooperative development program. This is not one of those programs where the U.S. gets money, we go off and we develop some stuff, and then we sell it back to Japan. What I'd like to talk you through is and get you to understand the complexity of what we've done in this program. So Japan has taken, through their Ministry of Defense, they've invested their own dollars to develop their portions of this missile. Okay, so if you look at the steering control section of this missile, you look at the second and third stage rocket motor, and you look at the nose cone, those have all been developed by Japan with Japanese contractors. Okay, they paid for it with contracts from the Ministry of Defense of Japan with the Japanese contractors. They developed it to the requirements that we jointly agreed on, and then they provided that to the United States, where what we've done in our development is we've developed a more capable kinetic warhead, which improves the seeker, again, which gives us more battle space. It gives us ability to see further. And we've done what we call the divert and attitude control system, which is really the end game. If you think about a ballistic missile in space and you're trying to hit that bullet with another bullet, you've got error. Right, so we have to divert at the end, and this gives us a lot more capability to do that in the end game. So we've done that in the United States, and then what we've done is we've taken all of that and we've done the overall integration with Japan. So, you know, if you really think about that, that's a pretty daunting challenge, right? And to date, we've been extremely successful in doing that with our partners. We've done countless tests. We've done tests in Japan of all the Japanese components. We've done testing in the U.S. of all of our components. And based on all of that, getting to these flight tests, we've now actually transitioned to where we're qualifying all these so we can eventually get to production, and I'll talk to you about that in a second. So the way we've done this program is, before you want to go do an intercept, you want to make sure you've got it right. Okay. So what we did was, in late 2015, we did what we called a control test vehicle. Shot. Okay, and what that is, and I talked to you about, I took the Japanese components, we integrated with the U.S. components, we built a full-up missile, and with that missile, we just did a pre-planned flyout to make sure that we got it right, to make sure that all of the integration, all of the components, you know, in a flight environment were going to work the way we thought they would work after we did all the ground testing. Both of those, extremely successful. So if you really stop for a minute and think about that, right? So you think about what it takes to fly a missile in space, what it takes to hit a bullet with a bullet, as we routinely say. That's a pretty huge feat for a single nation. Now add the complexity of one nation's designing and building half of the system, another nation's designing and building the other half of the system. We're bringing all that together, and then we're going to fly that thing. We did it. We didn't do it once. We did it twice on these control test vehicles to prove that integration, and both of them worked exactly like all of our analysis said, exactly like all of our models said, and they were extremely successful. So what that did was, that then gave us the confidence to say, okay, we can do this. We can certainly do this. And then based on that, then the next thing is now we got to prove that we can actually get something. So in February of this past year, in Hawaii out at the Pacific Missile Range Facility, we did just that. We did our first intercept test with the Standard Missile Block 2A against a medium-range ballistic missile target. And I will tell you, it was awesome. We had all of our Japanese counterparts there. My counterpart was there, Mr. Ino, others from Ministry of Defense, others from industry, from MHI was there. And we had a successful intercept off the John Paul Jones, and we got it right the first time. Okay, so think about what that means. We're taking all this advanced technology. We're taking two countries. We're shoving them together, who at times have different types of cultures on how we do things. And we weren't successful once. We weren't successful twice. We were successful three times. And we've only flown three times. So I consider that an unbelievable partnership, right? And so now, based on that, we've got our models anchored. We're confident that we've got the design right. And so we will do our second, what we call development flight test intercept, third quarter of this coming year. And then that will allow us in a development environment to say, okay, we're ready to go. And based on that, we will now start to look at how we transition this system to production. Okay? And so later on this year, as the team continues to work through this, we'll take this capability, we'll finish qualification, we'll look at, we're going to do some additional flight testing in an operational environment, not a development environment, and we'll continue to mature that system. But again, it's all about when we get into production and we start delivering these assets to our U.S. Aegis BMD ships and the Japan Aegis BMD ships, it's all about expanding the battle space, more capability for both our nations against some of these more advanced threats. And so, with that, I'd like to say, I'd be remiss if I didn't take an opportunity to talk about our people, okay? My folks hear me say this all the time, okay? All this technology that I just talked to you about, expanding the battle space, hitting a bullet with a bullet, being able to develop a computer system on a ship that will launch one of these things, that will tell it where to go, that will help you do that intercept, that's great. That's great technology, and that's exactly what we need. But, none of this happens without people. Brilliant people. Brilliant people, dedicated, motivated people. And I tell you, we've got it in the United States. We've got it with our allies in Japan. And we are lockstep in everything that we do in this program. Last week, let me give you a good example. So last week I was in Japan. We have an executive steering committee that myself and my counterpart do periodically. And so I was in Japan to do one of those meetings. But what I said was I'd like to go to one of the Japanese suppliers and I'd like to talk to them. And I'd like to tour their factory, and I'd like to understand more about what they do. So we did that. We went down to IHI Aerospace in Tomioka, Japan. Okay, and what they do is they develop and produce the second and third stage rocket motors, which get delivered to the United States for integration. And I will tell you, the passion that those folks showed is absolutely equivalent to the passion as I've gone through our U.S. plants. If you know anything about my background, I'm a rocket motor guy. I love rocket motors. And so I've been in a lot of U.S. plants as well. And I will tell you, the passion and the dedication and the knowledge that our Japanese industry counterparts have is absolutely on par with our world-class facilities that we have in the United States. So we had two world-class organizations. We have world-class contractor partners that we've brought together, and this is really one of those ones where one and one, I think, makes two and a half, to be honest with you, because it has truly, truly been a success. So we'll continue to work this. This is absolutely needed capability for both of our countries in the region and for what we're going to deliver both to our U.S. ships and our Aegis ballistic missile defense ships. So I really look forward to the continued partnership. I think it's a model, and as we transition to production, we will continue this partnership through that. So, with that,
thanks, John. Okay, could I just have you? Just for the audience.
Sure.
My understanding is I think we got six or seven Aegis BMD ships out of Yokosuka, the U.S., right. And we have four ships from Japan.
From Japan.
And just for the audience, the platform I think is the best multi-mission platform.
Sure.
and offers a series of layers of missile defense that nobody else does or can do. Can you sort of explain the difference? Because you focus your discussion on the SM-3 Block 2A, what the other systems on these ships are that are today defending Japan, and what's the difference between Japan's ships and our ships in that same defense, or if there's any, and the sensors and so forth on that one specific platform that you specialize in.
Yeah, sure, Ricky. So today, as Ricky said, so we've got U.S. Aegis ballistic missile defense ships in Yokosuka. And, of course, as we evolved this Aegis BMD program over time, we had various computer baselines, and we had various Standard Missile 3 weapons that we put on those. And so we got a mix of SM-3 Block 1As, which is the first really Standard Missile 3 variant that we built for ballistic missile defense. We're starting to put what is the next variant, which is called the Standard Missile Block 1B, which is more capability. It's a better seeker. And then we will eventually have the 2As. And in the latest computer baseline that we've got is called Aegis Baseline 9. And what that computer baseline does is it allows you to do multi-mission air and missile defense. Okay, so that means that a ship can be in an AAW mode at the same time it's in a ballistic missile defense mode, and they can cover multi-missions at the same time. In Japan, they have the older variant baseline as they bought through foreign military sales for their Aegis ships. So they've got ballistic missile defense capability with the SM-3 Block 1A. Okay, and so their plan is, and I'm not going to speak for how or when they're going to do it, but as part of the cooperative development, they will eventually buy the SM-3 Block 2A, which will then go into their newer Aegis BMD ships, which will give them comparable capability to what our latest baseline has as well. So they will get to the point where they have to rely less and less on the United States, and they will have the capability to completely protect themselves as we then play backstop for them as we help them do that coverage.
That's great, John.
Okay.
And just to top it off, those 10 or 11 ships today can completely, high confidence, completely defend 127 million people in Japan against the current threat that's sitting in North Korea.
So the threats that we are designed against, absolutely, Ricky. I mean, we have absolute high confidence. If you look at the success of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense Program, high confidence, absolutely.
Great, that's great. Thanks, Jack.
Yeah.
And as you were talking about the partnership, Is there any other program in the Pentagon that has shared a missile defense program of the amount of resources and partnership capacity that Japan and you have done with any other nation in the development of a system like this?
not in the way that we've done it for the cooperative development program. For what the agency has done, and I'm not an expert on this, so I'm going to go into zero detail. But you know, I think something that would start to get a little bit comfortable would be the defense of Israel, but nothing to what we've done with cooperative development, truly cooperative development.
And products going to go on both.
And products that can go in both
navies.
That's
both,
exactly.
Both
right.
Ships that's going to come out when it comes out. So.
Correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Our next guest, we're very privileged to have a member of the Japanese government and our embassy, the Japanese embassy here, Mr. Shoji, forgive me my Japanese, Maeda, here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for hosting this event. And it's my great honor to be on the panel to speak about the missile defense, and particularly I'd like to speak briefly about how the missile defense is understood in the overall Japanese security policy and strategy. I'm from the Foreign Service, so not the Ministry of Defense, but I cover the security and political and military affairs at the embassy, and I spend much time on the security policy and alliance management at the embassy. And to speak about the missile defense, I think it's important to share you the Japanese context to look at the missile defense and its policy. For us, Japan, North Korea has been, of course, one of the biggest security threats to Japan, and their missile program since the 90s and also their nuclear programs have been a great concern to Japan. And on many occasions, our policy makers, senior political leaders have talked about this threat and the importance of addressing that issue. And our security, a basic posture of our security policy has been based on the security treaty that we have with the United States for more than 70 years. And the alliance and the security policy under it is the key pillar of the Japan security policy. In terms of the missile defense, we have the Aegis-based SM-3 ballistic missile defense system and also the PAC-3 system. And those capabilities and our preparedness for the missile threats have been very big always in our security policy thinking. Recently, the Japan and the United States have adopted a new security or bilateral defense guidelines, which was in 2015. And we try to enhance the effectiveness of our bilateral alliance posture to the security threats surrounding us. And I would like to touch upon two elements in the defense guidelines which are relevant to the missile defense. One is the concept or the mechanism called Alliance Coordination Mechanism, and we decided to make this coordination mechanism as a standing mechanism for seamless coordination between Japan and the United States. The emphasis on this new scheme is on the timely information sharing and common situational awareness, and thinking behind this was to address the issue of gray zone threats that have been looming large in our security thinking. But I think the timely information sharing and common situational awareness are very relevant to the missile threat that we are talking about today. And also, there are another element in the bilateral defense guidelines relevant to the BND. Actually, this is about the BND in the guidelines. It says the two governments will cooperate to expand early warning capabilities, interoperability, network coverage, and real-time information exchange, and to pursue the comprehensive improvement of capabilities to respond to the threat of ballistic missiles. So those are all the ideas and concepts that we have in mind as we pursue our SM-3 projects and other development of posture against ballistic missile threats. I would like to add one other factor into this overall thinking, which is our cooperation with the Republic of Korea. This trilateral cooperation among Japan, the United States, and the Republic of Korea is a very important element and effective one, we believe, in terms of information sharing and coordination to address the threat. And we have been undertaking a lot of efforts to promote this notion of trilateral partnership. And as Ricky and Johnny mentioned, recently, North Korean threats have been seen as ever increasing again. Recently, we've seen two nuclear tests, more than 20 ballistic missile tests last year. Recently, also multiple missile launch tests, and there has been a talk of different trajectory or mobile launchers and so on. So it's getting common to say, at least in Japan, that this threat of North Korea has reached a new level. We are really concerned about the new threat. And against this background, recently Secretary of Defense Mattis visited Japan in the beginning of February, and that was the first overseas trip for this new Secretary of Defense to the Republic of Korea and Japan, which in itself was a very strong message for us, a very reassuring message in itself. But Secretary Mattis and our Japanese senior political leaders discussed the nuclear, North Korean nuclear and missile programs as the as large security threat to Japan, and also Secretary reaffirmed the United States' extended deterrence provided for Japan. And 1 week later, Prime Minister Abe came to the United States, and he had a very successful meeting, series of meetings actually, with President Trump, and they issued a joint statement on February the 10th, in which they also emphasized this notion that we are addressing together between Japan and the United States to address the common challenge in the region. And in the joint statement, it said, the U.S.-Japan alliance is fully capable of ensuring the security of Japan. The United States is fully committed to defending its homeland forces and allies through the full range of U.S. military capabilities. And it also said, they also reaffirmed the importance of trilateral cooperation among the United States, Japan, and the Republic of Korea, just as I mentioned about the trilateral partnership. And against or in the context of such a comprehensive security strategy, we have been pursuing the development of our ballistic missile defense capabilities. And SM-3 to Block 2A is one of the leading model case for our cooperative project with the United States. And actually, that joint study has been not only the symbol in the missile defense field, but also the entire bilateral joint enterprise for Japan and the United States. And we have other plans to further strengthen our missile defense posture, including more BMD-capable Aegis ships, PAC-3, additional PAC-3 assets or radars. And we have been hosting United States missile defense assets in Japan as well. There are two TP-2 radars in Shariki and Kyogamisaki. And as Admiral said, there are other Aegis, BMD-capable Aegis ships deployed to the West Pacific. So in conclusion, I'd like to come back to the what's written on the defense guidelines. It says, in terms of the ballistic missile defense, the self-defense forces will have primary responsibility for conducting ballistic missile defense operations to defend Japan. The United States Armed Forces will conduct operations to support and supplement the self-defense forces operation. And Japan has been developing its own ballistic missile defense capabilities. And the thinking behind that is that as Japan strengthens its missile defense posture, it will deny the adversary's attempt to create a fait accompli at the initial stage of conflict. And further, it will contribute to the credibility, enhancement of the credibility of U.S. defense commitment. So this, we believe, is the way to further enhance the alliance deterrence capability, and we are eager to continue our efforts to build on what we have been doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We would like to thank you again for coming. Could you just, from your perspective, because you're in the region with that actor, what are the solutions with that problem, other than increasing your capability to defend your country? Are there other solutions that Japan is looking at trying to reduce that problem? Is that a fair
right.
question? I want to put you on the spot.
Yes.
Just wanted to
of course, yes. So we have been doing the missile defense. We have been investing a lot of resources in the missile defense capability. And as the threat continues to grow, it is only natural for us to think about a lot of, you know, comprehensive ways to address these situations. I hesitate to go into any details here, but of course, I'm from the Foreign Service, so I'm a little biased into toward that direction as well. As we increase our capability, we also have diplomatic avenue to look at the solutions and also the not only about the capability, military capability itself, the very messaging efforts that I've laid out at the senior level engagement and others, to show the alliance solidarity and to show, to enhance the credibility of the alliance capability is one, you know, the examples of our efforts to address the current situation.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. We'd like to open up the speakers to any questions of the audience.
I'm Zach from MDIA. I had a question for Rear Admiral Bull. I believe the trilateral exercises between South Korea, Japan, and the United States are wrapping up today. I was just kind of curious as to the command and control elements that are used to link those assets of each country together, and how they can kind of work together in the missile defense realm. To kind of go into like the limitations of that capability, their interoperability.
So I will hesitate to go into any great detail, okay? But it kind of goes back to the discussion that we had on capabilities of each one of the Navy's ships. Certainly, if you look at South Korea, because they don't have Aegis BMD, their ability to do anything in that realm right now is not there from a ship perspective. If you look at from a Japan perspective, because they do have Aegis BMD on their ships, as we discussed, they have the ability to start to look at how they would interoperate. I'm not a surface fleet guy, but when they go out, they look at opportunities to figure out how to get the architecture right, how to get the link set up right, so that they can have good, meaningful sharing of data as they start to do that. So the fleet continues to work that. All of the fleets continue to work that as they move forward.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Justin Doubleday with Inside Defense. For Admiral Wolf, I was wondering if you just talk to kind of the effects of the ongoing continuing resolution on your priorities at MDA, and then for Mr. Maeda, what are kind of the secondary effects from your view of the budget uncertainty here in the U.S.?
So right now, from my perspective for the continuing resolution, we are continuing to move programs forward, obviously staying within what we're allowed to do from a continuing resolution standpoint. But the agency in general has prioritized what those are. For this program to date, again, we haven't seen impacts. We continue, as you can tell, we're continuing. We did the flight test in February. We'll do another flight test in May as the CR gets worked through. But today, we've seen not huge impacts for us to continue to move forward in this program. Okay.
As for the budget debate in the United States, of course, it's up to the United States government and Congress to decide on the U.S. defense budget. We've been closely watching the debate in the United States because we consider it has an important messaging perspective. But we have already been encouraged by the willingness of the government and also the Congress to increase the defense budget. We will continue to closely monitor the debate in this country.
Thanks, Vicky. Lee Bolio, Voice of America. Admiral, I have a question. I think Ricky earlier asked you whether you have high confidence to defend 130 million Japanese people against North Korea missile set. You said yes. But do you have the same kind of degree of high confidence on defending South Korea and U.S. ships, U.S. troops and facilities in that region as well against North Korea? And then for the Japanese colleague here, and I wonder if you can talk about that earlier threat or concern expressed by President Trump. Earlier he said allies, including Japan, had not contributed enough to their own defense, so relying on more and more on the United States. I'm wondering if that was a fair assessment, and is it getting better in terms of your contribution? Please, thanks.
So as far as the question for me, so what I would say is South Korea is a different challenge than what Japan is, and as we continue to work through that, I don't get involved in the policy part of this or some of the other decisions that are being made by those countries. What I would say is I could get you with our PAO and get you in touch with the right folks that are working solutions like that and other things which the South Koreans are looking at, but that kind of falls outside of what my area of responsibility is, if that's fair.
Okay, thanks.
About the Japan's burden sharing, I think you're referring to, and the recent debate about that. Of course, as I said, for Japan, our alliance with the United States has been the central part, core part of our security policy. And as I described, even in terms of the missile defense capability, we have been developing our own capability to increase our own defense posture. And that has been the case all the way through the history of the alliance. And of course, we are also open to the idea of constantly reviewing and discussing what roles we should bear in the workings of the alliance security posture. And the Prime Minister, when he came here, talked with the President about future workings of the alliance, and we will constantly look at how better we could address the common challenge with the capability of the alliance.
I'd just add that there's nobody that's invested more money and more support in ballistic missile defense than Japan, and it is the example of the world. I don't believe it's within the President's perspective on which countries are not contributing. It's the opposite. It's the leader, and you saw President Trump say 100% support behind Japan and the investments that we've done over billions of dollars, and they've contributed that amount too. Signifies that is the example of the partnership that we want to have with our allies in defending these regions around the world.
Thank you for the opportunity today. Jim Cho from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And I wanted to ask a little bit about the evolution of the co-development program and kind of at the initial stages, how was the burden sharing or the divvying up of some of these different responsibilities for the different components of the program put together and determined? And then looking forward, as this program potentially evolves, after this whole experience, is there some thought about realigning that, or adding certain things, or adjusting, or actually some types of corporate mergers or joint ventures of some kind to put this together? So I wanted to ask your memory and impression of that.
So I was not here. I mean, I've been in this job for about 2.5 years, so I was not here when the whole program actually got started. But I can tell you generally how we've divvied out a lot of this. Most of the way we got in the U.S. to developing the kinetic warhead and the seeker, a lot of that is what we call, critical program information that we have decided that we need to maintain that, right? So when you look at rocket motors and things of that nature, so I think there was a natural break that said critical program information that's been developed by the United States that the United States wants to hold on to, That's in that technology, and then other technologies that Japan had when it comes to rocket motor development, some of that was that break. Again, because it's part of the standard missile family, because we wanted to keep the booster the same, because we wanted to use the same VLS, because it didn't make sense to drive changes in that, the United States kept the integration of that, because those are exactly what we've got on the rest of the standard missiles and the VLSs that we have on the ship. And then I think the second part of your question is what are we looking at moving forward? So, that's a great question. I think As we continue to understand the capability of this particular weapon and we continue to look at evolving threats and where it's at, we will continue to figure out how we go and do that, whether it's through modernization and obviously anything that our counterparts have been involved with. There will certainly be discussions about how, if it's in a rocket motor, how do we collaboratively go and do that to develop that technology. So I would say, is there a future plan today? Nothing in concrete. Do I think there could be? Absolutely, in the future, depending on how we move forward.
I'm Steve Traver from Congress and Pierce's office. For Admiral Wolf, sir, is this helping in any way our development of the Aegis Ashore architectures that we're looking at now in various places around the world?
So here's how I'll speak to that. So absolutely, I mean, it's public knowledge that this missile will go into the Aegis Ashore sites in Poland and Romania at some point once we get into production. As a matter of fact, as part of EPA Phase 3, that's one of the weapons that will be there along with the 1B. Outside of that, there is no future plans right now on Aegis Ashores or using this weapon in an Aegis Ashore. So it'll be in the ships, and it'll be in the two Aegis Ashore sites from a U.S. perspective.
David Cook with Strategic Sentinel. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. The last administration canceled the development of the SM-3 Block 2B. Do you see a likelihood that the new administration will restart it? And do you see a need for that? Would you like to see it restarted?
So I understand that the 2B was canceled because, again, we were in the 2A development and we were looking at the technologies, looking at the size. So that's why it got canceled. Do I know in the future if this administration? I'm not involved at this point in the policy of that. Do I think that at some point we need to continue to look at technologies to stay ahead of the threat? Yes. Do I know what that is today? No, but we continue to look at that and evaluate that. Our focus right now is getting through the 2A development, getting the 2A in production, because, again, for both of our countries, that's an incredible capability enhancement that we need. And then we'll continue to do what we normally do in the program management world and say, okay, what is the next thing I need to look at, and how do we prioritize that with everything else that the Missile Defense Agency has across Admiral Sirin's portfolio?
Can I just go back and into that SM-3 Block 2A missile? What it does that we can't do today, it can reach much further.
Can reach much further
than the 1Bs or the 1As, which allows you to have more shots and earlier intercept, which defends much greater areas. And that's why it's so powerful for the country of Japan in that situation over anything else. That capability.
It allows us to do an intercept further out, right, and it gives us more divert capability to be more accurate, to absolutely guarantee we can get that.
And is that going to be affordable for both countries? Is it going to be, and when will that system, do you think, if everything goes right for you, when does it go into field first operation?
So, good question. So, I would say, is it going to be a system that both countries can afford? I would say today, because we're not in production and we're still in development, I would not put a cost tag on buying a round today. Obviously, we will continue to look for development for every opportunity to make sure when we get into production, we will be efficient and we will get the cost of the round as efficiently as we can. So that's kind of that portion. The plan is, as we've gone through the development, we're looking at starting production, transition to production, like I said, this year, looking at an FY18 potential production as we move forward. Because up to today, we've worked on the development of the test rounds as we've gone forward.
Does that mean IOS, that means they're in the ships 2018?
So, yeah, that's a Navy call. So we will start delivering by the end of calendar year 18 some quantity of SM-3 Block 2As to the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy will decide how they source that across the globe based on their priorities and where they want to send those.
And what are the milestones you have to achieve before you get to that production position for your respective
So it kind of goes to back to where I said, Ricky, where we're at. So we need to finish up the second flight test. And then based on that, we will start our transition production. We've got to finish qualification, which we're on track to finish qualification. And then later on, we will do a series of what we call normal mission flight tests to continue to show the capability of that, so that as we work through, we can get a we can qualify, we can get a production contract, we can get into production and start producing those and delivering.
And then would those Japan ships be capable of carrying that, or do they have to be upgraded?
So the Japan ships will have to be upgraded to a baseline 9, so today, but as they look at what they're going to do with their current ships and how they might backfit those and what they're doing with the future ships that they will purchase, they will decide what that mix is and which one of their ships has that capability.
So the U.S. ships are the ones that have that capability to defend Japan for
Our baseline ships will have that capability
before they become online. So correct. That's our responsibility. Okay. Any other questions? Ken?
All right, well, first, thanks for a great event, Ricky. Gentlemen, congratulations really are in order. I'm a former deputy director at NBA, and I saw firsthand that, first of all, the leadership from Admiral Wolf to really get the program where, as he mentioned, 3 for 3 and then some. And Mr. Maeda, congratulations to you, and a word of thanks. As Ricky also said, the level of cooperation seen between our two nations is really unprecedented. And I wish that we, from the United States perspective, would see that in a lot more nations around the world. So thank you for that. My question really is for you, sir, though. And you mentioned North Korean threat sort of at an all-time high. I absolutely agree. But it's not just a ballistic missile. It's going to be also, if an attack comes, and we all hope that it doesn't, but if one does come, it's not going to be just from ballistic missiles. It's also going to be from the air. It's also going to be from unmanned aerial systems, potentially. So the fact that you have a ballistic missile capability is great, but what is Japan doing as a nation to sort of deal with the integrated air and missile defense threat? Are you worried about that as well? And are there opportunities for our nations to cooperate in that arena as well as the ballistic?
Yes. I think the description of the threat environment that you described is shared very much among the Japanese policymakers as well. The proof of that is that the concept of integrated air and missile defense has already been the bilateral defense guidelines I've been referring to many times in my talks. So with the United States, we are jointly developing the posture to address the entire spectrum of the air and missile defense according to the guidelines, and that's one of our efforts to enhance our alliance capability to address this entire spectrum of the security threat to Japan.
You seem to underplay the engineering feats that you accomplished by having two different languages, two different countries doing two different parts of stuff, putting it all together to have a capability that it's got. And does it have any residual capability at all for longer range capability than the current short medium range that it's attacked for? Or is it just that's its requirement? Does it have, say, ICBM or anything like that, or is that not to be?
So the requirements for the SM-3 Block 2A are for intermediate and medium range ballistic missiles. It's not designed to defeat ICBMs. Okay. That's not in the threat space. It's not in the design space. So it is today a medium range, intermediate range ballistic missile regional weapon.
So the length from Iran to Europe, which it's designed to do, is not an ICBM range.
It's correct. That's why we look at the medium range and intermediate range for things.
Okay. All right. Anybody else on questions? Well, thank you very much for coming. It was great to really highlight this SM-3 Block 2A, which got snuck under the news because the North Koreans fired within 4 days after you made that great accomplishment. And the great partnership, the outstanding partnership of Japan that I think every country, we would want to emulate that relationship to build our missile defenses around the world and to be more capable with them. So thank you both for taking the time today and talking to our audience and
great.
Educating